Welcome to today's episode of Positively Geared. I'm joined with Lloyd. Hi, Lloyd.
Hi, Alex.
Today we're going to be speaking about buying the first home. Lloyd, if we can just rewind, say, 20 odd years ago when you were fresh from the country, moved to Sydney and very much a muso at the time. I know at that point you've previously mentioned that you weren't quite sure whether or not property was something that you wanted to invest in over the longer period of time. Can we revisit that time and talk about what you did when you were first looking to get into the market and your, I guess, initial introduction to property?
Yeah, well, I guess originally when I first moved to Sydney and I studied at uni and then I was doing some gigs and teaching music and things, investing of any sort was the last thing on my mind, which was, in hindsight, was a bit ridiculous to me, but it really was the last thing on my mind. And considering that economics was actually my best subject at school, better subject than music, that's quite surprising. But nevertheless, yeah, at the time, teaching music, I was doing a few gigs, had very little money to the point that even, I was on a study at the time and I couldn't even afford to eat properly. I was often eating ice cream cones and things for lunch and things like that. So it was quite funny at the time, especially when I look back on it now. But I was always quite frugal. And although I had no real plans of what sort of investment or anything I'd do, I knew I wanted to save money because I didn't like the idea of having no money. And I really thought that I just wanted to have some money that I could do something with in the future. And I was very frugal in the way that I never had any credit cards. I never bought a new car at the time. I used to drive a really old 1979 petrol guzzling Ford Falcon at the time. And I didn't go on any overseas holidays at the time. In fact, I didn't even go overseas until I bought my first property. And that was a commitment I made to myself at the time. So all in all, yep, I was really saving. And then sort of later on throughout my 20s, I started to get a little bit of interest in property, but it wasn't even as an investment. It was actually to buy a property to live in, so I didn't have to pay rent at the time. And that's when I first bought the first property at Rockdale, which was just a one-bedroom apartment, which essentially I had around about $30,000 saved up, which sort of covered the deposit and the costs and things.
So a lot of those decisions, Lloyd, that you made were obviously conscious ones, not to travel, to go without all the shiny bells and whistles of whether it be a new vehicle or whatever the case may be. At that time, property was still not quite on the radar, was it?
It wasn't on the radar at all. No, absolutely not.
You mentioned, Lloyd, in conversation off air that there was a sort of a point in time you got to where you realized that there's no such thing as job security. Would you say that that was possibly the driving point or pivotal point whereby you realize that you need to do more than just save money and be frugal to build financial security?
Yeah, absolutely, Alex. So I did realize, and this was around about the time of the GFC when I was seeing a few things happen, seeing a few people laid off in my place of work at the time, and just generally around the globe. And I thought, job security is a bit of a myth. And I thought, you really need to start investing. At that time, I owned one property, which is my property at Rockdale that I lived in. And I thought, I really need to start investing. And I realized that property was a good vehicle for me because it's less volatile than things like shares. So that's what I really wanted to get into. But I thought, you need to create multiple sources of income and have something that actually supplies you with some good cash flow rather than just relying on a job, which may or may not be with you in the future, depending on whether your boss needs you.
So honing in on around the time you bought the property in Rockdale, putting, I suppose, that to the side in terms of what that did for you in growing a portfolio, Lloyd, do you remember that experience quite vividly? Obviously, at the time, not quite knowing that 20 years down the track, you would obviously have built quite a substantial portfolio of properties. What was that experience like? And do you remember it quite well?
I remember the experience of buying the property really well. I had no idea what I was doing. My first time of dealing with real estate agents, really pushy real estate agents, and they could see me coming from a mile off. So inexperienced there. I was working with a mortgage broker. So it was my first experience with a mortgage broker, which is fantastic because in my situation, I really needed the assistance of a broker rather than going with a bank. But it was a pretty interesting situation because my broker was doing his best to get the loan over the line. But the real estate agent was actually calling my broker every day, wondering what the status of my finances is up to. And that's kind of a bit of a no-no. But that's what was happening at the time because obviously the agent was really trying to close this deal and everything. In terms of the property itself, in the back of my mind, I think I kind of thought that this would be some kind of investment one day. So it was kind of near the water. It was near amenities and things like that. But without really having any kind of investment plan in place, I knew that this would be something that I would use as an investment in the future, although I didn't plan on having a large portfolio at the time.
What I find really interesting, Lloyd, you know, looking back retrospectively on where you were then and to what you've built now, what a lot of listeners might find quite intriguing is that you didn't actually build a lot of equity through that first purchase, did you? It wasn't necessarily a case of you just buying equity, buy the next one, rinse and repeat.
Well, that's absolutely right, Alex. And these days I do tell people that you should really only have the deposit saved for your first purchase, and then you can buy subsequent properties using equity. With that first purchase, however, I bought it kind of at the wrong time in the cycle. So it was just after the boom of the Sydney 2000 Olympic Games, and the markets were going flat. In fact, Sydney property prices were just in decline at the time. So over the next few years, I didn't actually make much growth at all in the property. So when it came time to buy my next property, I had to rely on the savings that I'd been continuing to save to get into my next purchase.
And in terms of using those savings at the time, because, you know, we really want to hone in on, I suppose, your journey and your learnings throughout those early years. Was there any, I suppose, sense of not wanting to use those savings at the time? Or was it pretty much, obviously, given that there wasn't a firm strategy in place, was it just a case of, okay, well, this is what I need to do to sort of move up the ladder, so to speak?
Look, I was always very comfortable to use the savings towards buying property. And even these days, I'm comfortable to use money to buy property. And my wife will testify to the fact that I won't spend $20 on a t-shirt, but I will spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on a property. So I'm very happy to spend money on property because it's a good investment. So I'm happy to save and put money into a property, knowing that that's going to be a good investment vehicle to help reach, you know, financial freedom in the future.
Just revisiting the first experience you mentioned, the estate agent was handling the mortgage broker, and obviously, it was all new to you at the time. Did that sort of first experience set the tone for future purchases, Lloyd?
I think from that, I just learned a lot how to deal with real estate agents and what to say and what not to do. And I certainly learned a good experience on how to negotiate. I think when I first, you know, looking at properties and stuff, I was a bit hesitant to negotiate a lot. And that's something that you should never really be scared to do, is really put up your hand and offer a good figure on properties. And unfortunately, I did get my first property at a pretty good price, but that was more because of what the market was doing, more so than my good negotiation skills at the time.
So that was back in 2003.
That's correct.
Fast forward to 2018, you've finally bought your dream home. At the time, it wasn't so apparent back in 2003 that you would go on to do what you did. The journey to that point, I think you mentioned it was around 4 years into that first purchase where you had a light bulb moment. You said, you know what? This is a great way to build the financial security that I want. You had that realization that money in the bank is just not going to get you where you need to go. From there, would you say that was the point where it really started to snowball?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it started to snowball from there because I still made a few investment mistakes, didn't really have a strategy in place, although I did start to acquire more properties. And at the time, I wasn't clear on my goals. So I'm very big these days on making sure that people are clear on their goals. I didn't have a clear goal on whether I wanted a dream home, whether I wanted to live by the water, or whether I wanted to pay for kids' education or anything like that. But what I did know is that in my current work situation, that I wouldn't have a big income. I guess I wouldn't have a lot of superannuation, and I didn't want to rely on the pension. They were the driving forces to me wanting to get ahead in investing so that I didn't have to rely on the pension in the future.
Lloyd, looking back from when you started in 2003 to today, probably the biggest change we have seen is that the barrier to entry into the Sydney and Melbourne markets, as an example, are quite high now. And it's not to say they weren't high back then, because it's always relative to the time, right? However, for people that you're working with today within your buyer's agency firm, how do you deal with some of the challenges they might be facing in terms of being discouraged, having a strategy in place, but being so early into it that they haven't seen anything materialize yet?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Alex, because a lot of time people do want to invest in Sydney or in Melbourne or one of the other capitals, and they just don't have enough deposits saved up, sometimes not enough borrowing capacity. So we need to look at markets outside of the capitals, but also look at the strategies on what you can do with those properties. So some good examples are actually buying properties on large blocks of land, so a house and large block of land, and perhaps looking at doing a subdivision there and creating equity through the subdivision, through creating the new block. So you're actually creating equity there. And that then potentially allows you to go and buy another property with that increased equity, or you may sell that new block of land you created, take that profit and use that as a deposit for your next purchase. So that's actually increasing the amount of equity you've got available to get into bigger property deals. And we've had some good success doing that kind of scenario with people that may only have $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in deposit. If you go to regional centres and get a good block of land and do something like that, you can actually make some good value that way and really get ahead. I'll just give you a bit of an example, is that if you go in and you buy a block of land for $400,000, for example, might be 1,000 squares, it's got a house in the front of it, and then you subdivide it. So you're going to build a new block of land at the back, which is 600 squares, and the front is going to be 400. That front house on the 400 squares, although it's a lot smaller than the original block you bought, is still going to get a pretty good valuation. And based on the comparables around, you might still get a valuation on that house for around about $350K. But the new block that you've created, that might actually get you a valuation of $200K just on the vacant block. So all of a sudden, the $400K initial purchase that you've made, you've actually now got two valuations that equal $550. So you've actually created $150,000 in equity there, minus the costs, for example, of subdivision that might be around the $20,000 to $30,000 mark. So that's just a way of creating a bit of equity there. And you can actually sell that vacant land or you might be able to build on that in the future. But that's a way of actually being able to build up your portfolio a little bit quicker and actually get into the market, get onto the ladder, and gradually work your way into buying to those capital cities.
Lloyd, one of the most commonly asked questions that I'm sure you receive, and anyone working within the space of property, whether it's from the financial industry or a buyer's agent or a selling agent, is how much money do we actually need to buy a property? And obviously there's no clear-cut answer because there's so many moving parts and variables to saying, okay, well, Lloyd, based on your position and what you're looking to purchase, you need X, Y, Z. There are also instances where I know that I come across a lot of clients, and I'm sure it's the same, where they've actually got, substantial savings in the bank, but there's this mentality that, oh, we need to keep saving. We don't have enough yet. We need 30% deposit before we can buy. And I think, for anybody listening today that might be in that position, it's really important to reiterate the point that you might be ready to go to market. In fact, you might be in a position to buy multiple properties and, really start creating some instant leverage in building a portfolio.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where the advice of a good mortgage broker comes in handy. And then the advice of a buyer's agent or a property investment advisor who can look at your situation, because you might have enough deposit saved up ready that you can put down a 10% deposit and you can borrow the rest. Or if you've got 30% deposit saved up, you might be able to actually buy a couple of properties plus the costs and really get a foot on the ladder. And you might think you don't have enough, but you actually might. So you really seeking that advice and then putting a strategy in place to be able to move forward. Because really, depending on what the strategy is and what you're trying to do, how much money do you need to get into a property? Well, if you buy a property in a regional area and it's $300,000, then you essentially need 10% deposit is $30,000 deposit plus the stamp duty and the legals, for example. So that's an example of being able to get in on the cheaper side. I don't recommend getting into a property like that unless you're actually going to do something with the property. That might be a renovation. It might be a subdivision where you can create some equity, because in those sort of regions, you'll have slower growth than what you would in the capital cities. So you've got to have a strategy behind it. But getting into a market like that allows you to get a foot in the door. Likewise, if you're someone that's got a much higher deposit saved and a much higher borrowing capacity, doesn't mean you spend it all on one property, because then you've got all your eggs in the one basket. Speak to a buyer's agent, and maybe diversify that across a couple of properties, maybe one in Melbourne, one in Sydney, for example, and that'll actually help you really get ahead as well.
Lloyd, I guess going back to more grassroots, when you were still teaching in the eastern suburbs at the time, I think you would at some point, once you started to realise that, property is a great way to create wealth, you had established Oz Property Professionals in its most, I suppose, basic form. Is that fair to say at the time?
I was still teaching, and I actually had Oz Property Professionals going. But going back a little bit earlier than that, I actually had a blog going, which was actually called Oz Property Powwow. A bit of a funny story there. I started the blog really because my wife actually said to me, you need to start a blog so that I don't have to listen to you talk about property at home all the time. So that's a bit of a running joke we still have. But I started the blog, and which is simply just free information. I was just writing about property, strategies that I've used, some of the success I've had and things like that, and just general information. And then I started to get a few inquiries and people wanting to, to get some assistance and things like that. And then I ended up getting my real estate qualifications and things like that. And I then actually had my buyer's agency commence while I was actually still teaching. But at that time, I also had a positively geared property portfolio. So I had a lot of things actually happening there, but I'd already made the decision that I was going to retire from teaching, but I had these other things in place as well.
If we can just hone in on that a little bit more, I think a lot of people, knowing what you've done and where you are today, will be quite intrigued in the decisions you've made, because I suppose everybody in life's always trying to make the right decisions. Nobody wants to make the wrong ones. How did you know that it was time to hang up the boots, so to speak, as far as being a teacher was concerned? I know you sort of touch on this in the book. Was it losing passion for teaching? Was it more a case of, okay, well, we really see this as Oz Property is a great vehicle for us to continue to create wealth and also do something that you're really passionate about?
Yeah, so one of the things about teaching was, I guess at some stage, was sort of losing that passion, losing that drive, and also being tied down to that 9-to-5 job, which I wasn't passionate about anymore. Not so much the job itself, but the 9-to-5 and working for a boss. I felt that I didn't want that. So that's something that was very important, and something that I've been working for years to free myself of. And I'd built up a portfolio that was cash flow positive, and the rental income from my portfolio actually replaced my teaching salary before I quit the job. Yeah, that's important to note as well, because that's a lot of people's goals and things as well. The other thing about what I do now is I've actually combined two passions really. So teaching and property. So these days I essentially teach people about property, or I educate people about property. So I'm actually combining education and property. So I've still got that element of teaching. You know, a lot of people ask me, why do I do what I do when I've got a big property portfolio? Why don't I just keep doing that? But one of the reasons for starting Oz Property Professionals was essentially to help other people replicate what I've done, to show people that it can be done. And also, you know, to look at the bigger picture, and that is to actually, you know, create funds and the freedom to actually donate to charities and things like that. For example, you know, we donate regularly to the Cancer Council. This year, in January and February, we donated a substantial amount of money to the Bushfire Appeal. And in the future, we want to be able to assist in education and maybe building homes for third world countries in Nepal and Africa. So they're things that are very close to my heart. And that's one of the things about having a business and growing the business, is so you can actually help people in less fortunate situations than I am. So that's kind of the bigger picture of Oz Property Professionals and where I want to lead with it.
Lloyd, what I love about your story is that, whether by design or not, over time you've made that gradual transition from teacher to buyer's agent, then to obviously continuing to build a really good portfolio of properties and helping a lot of people along the way. And you know, as you just voiced, you know, also being able to do some things which are really close to your heart, you know, in the form of giving back. What I find quite often, with not all but some people, is that they're always focused on one thing, and almost, as you said, they've got all their eggs in one basket. So for example, I was having a conversation with a gentleman the other day, and you know, he was asking me, oh, how's the property market going? And we're just having a brief chat over coffee, and I sort of said, oh, look, you know, have you invested, have you considered investing, what's your current situation, so on and so forth. And he said, oh no, I'm really just honed in on building a business for the moment. Now, that person's been building that business now for several years. You've sort of managed to do both at the same time without sacrificing one for the other. For people that possibly don't know how to do that, do you have any tips or takeaways? Was it organically that just happened?
I think it happened organically, but I think you make a few mistakes. But what's important is that you do need to understand that you should have multiple sources of income. So if you just have a business by itself, and then something happens, and then you don't have any income, like for example what happened in the recent COVID-19 pandemic for some businesses, and then you could be in some trouble. And so same as if you have a 9-to-5 job and you lose the job, then you've got issues there, and that's happened to some people. What's really important is that if you're going to have a business, that you should have some investments as well, and a few things. And I've always thought along those lines, is that if something happens to my business, I've still got my property portfolio that pays me income. So, I'm never stressed about money from any perspective there. I used to be stressed about money. You know, when I was at university, I had no money, and I really wanted to put myself in a better position. So I know what it's like to have no money and everything like that. But I worked hard to put myself in a different position. And that meant really going without and really working hard to save and to set a plan. And to believe in myself. And one of the things that people, I think, do need to do is set that plan and then really have some belief and then keep themselves accountable to what they're trying to achieve. Yeah, it's definitely possible to do both, but also leverage is very important. So if you build a property portfolio, you can't manage all the properties yourself. For example, you need a property manager who can actually manage the properties themselves. So you're not actually dealing individually with the tenants and the rent and the problems that occur within the properties, if there are any. So you need to leverage. And same as when you're growing a business. When you first start out with a business, you kind of got to wear all the different types of hats. But as you grow, you need an accountant in the business. You need an IT person. You need to leverage there. And then you're just, as a business owner, you need to know a little bit about everything, but you don't need to be the expert in everything. You need to know how to leverage and get the right people in. And I always say that if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. So you do need to leverage and get good people around you that can actually help you grow your business. And whether your business is, a business in the true sense of the word there, or it's a property portfolio, which is also a business, you need to have the right advice and the right people around you.
I wholeheartedly agree. And, you know, we've touched on many times before, seeking out mentors, you know, seeking out people that have done what you want to do and learning from them, which I suppose is, you know, in line with the thought around, you know, if you're the smartest person in the room.
Well, that's very true, Alex. And I've said often, if you're interested in property and you want to get ahead in property, then you really need to seek out a property investor, whether that's just getting mentored from someone or you're seeking out a buyer's agent or something. Seek out someone who's actually achieved what you're trying to achieve. But it's the same in business. If you're going to get some business mentoring, make sure you're getting mentored from someone who's actually achieved in business, or they've had several multi-million dollar businesses and they know what they're talking about, so they can actually, you know, help you achieve what you're trying to achieve and things like that. So you really need to get the right sort of advice there. And don't be scared to ask for advice, because everybody, most successful people in the world, still have advisors and coaches. I mean, you look at the greatest athletes, they all have coaches, because people need, you know, bouncing boards and people to give them ideas and everything like that. So it's very important that we all seek ideas from people.
Lloyd, I recently read a quote, and I'm paraphrasing, but it really resonated with me. And it was that as you become wealthy, money doesn't actually change who you are. It just amplifies the person you've always been. I suppose the concept or notion behind that is that some people, as they build wealth, you know, you've probably seen someone or know somebody that said, "Oh, look at that bloody wanker," so on and so forth. What I love about you is you're very humble, and you know, I can tell that there's definitely a greater purpose behind what you're doing. Has your relationship with money changed at all, I suppose, from those early uni days when you were quite frugal?
It hasn't actually. I'm still very frugal now. The only difference now is that I do own a couple of nice cars, and I have a boat and things that I probably used to be able to afford, nor did I sort of want to buy them back then. And of course we live in a nice house and everything like that, but I'm still very frugal, and it's still all about saving and trying to get ahead and making sure that I have got enough savings and equity, you know, towards my next, my next investment and things like that. So it's really, and what you say is very true. And I think it's very important for people to understand that that money doesn't generally change people, especially if you've worked hard to acquire that money. You know, it brings out who you really are. So you can, with a lot of money, you can actually donate to charity. You can help for the greater good and everything like that. It's certainly, I think, you know, most very wealthy people are quite humble as well.
Listeners today are very fortunate, because I suppose they're getting a bit more of a deeper insight into your mindset behind, you know, the successful business you've built, behind the portfolio, behind everything in your book, Positively Geared. With that relationship with money that you mentioned hasn't changed too much, was it hard being a naturally frugal person to sort of almost give yourself permission to buy the boat, buy the car, and buy the dream home? Were there ever limiting beliefs around, you know, do I need this, or did you sort of see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, absolutely. And there was, for sure. Not so much about buying the dream home, because I think that was something I was definitely buying for our family and everything like that, and that was part of the goal. Certainly buying the boat and things like that is certainly like, do I really need that? Well, people who have boats don't really use boats, you know, everyone knows that and all that kind of stuff. So there's always an element of that. But part of that also, whether I'm buying a boat, whether I'm buying a nice car, it's kind of a bit of a reward. So I always look at, okay, how's my property portfolio been going? How's my business been going? How have I been going personally? Can I afford to do this? And when I say, can I afford to do this, it doesn't mean, oh, I've got a few thousand in the bank, so I should afford to do it. It comes down to, you know, have things gone really well for me, and have I got a little bit of extra that I can then put towards this? Because I want to make sure that whenever I do something, whenever I do spend money on that, it's actually only a small percentage of what I've actually got to spend on investing, which is really for the greater good.
Now, you mentioned before, Lloyd, even as recent as, I suppose, well, now the present that we're in, you know, you're constantly evaluating, okay, well, where's the next place to invest money into? You know, what does that look like? 20 years down the track, what does goal setting look like for you now?
Look, for me, it's now really becoming more about family. I think in the past, it was all about building up for the family I'd have in the future, making sure that I was secure for the family. Now, you know, we've got a gorgeous young son now, and I'm loving spending time with him. You know, when I'm buying investments now, it's really much, very much with him in mind that he'll be inheriting, you know, those properties and things like that. So, yeah, he has a lot to do with that. You know, in terms of, you know, putting him through school in the future and things like that, that's all part of the goal setting and everything. So things do change a little bit as you move on, depending on, you know, where you are, what stage you are in life and the certain goals. But essentially, on a broader spectrum, the goals are still the same, that you're looking to, you know, look after your family. You want that financial independence to continue. As a business, you want to donate for the greater good, and that's essentially what I'm trying to do.
For people listening who are parents, what's the mindset of Lloyd Edge in terms of parenting? And touched on your upbringing in quite some detail in previous episodes, and, you know, you go over it in the book. What learnings do you really want to bring to your child?
Look, the main thing that I think is really important is that I want him to treat others how he'd want to be treated himself, because that's the way I like to treat people. So however I'd like to be treated is how I want to treat other people. So I think that's very, very important. I think just having him grow up with some honesty, integrity and humility is really important. And to be really accepting, you know, for him to go to school with, you know, all types of financial circumstances. So we don't want to be in a situation where he's just around wealthy people. If his best friends are those that, you know, don't have a lot of money and stuff like that, that's sort of upbringing I want him to have, so that, you know, he really can share what he has with other people, and he's very humble about it.
Is it important to you that he eventually over time goes on to do similar things to what you've done? Or do you think it's important to give your son freedom to make their own decisions? And
what's important to me is that that Riley's happy with what he's doing. A lot of people say, oh, is he going to take over your business and things like that? He may not. Yeah, he might not. It really comes down to what he really wants to do. But I will be giving him a good education in terms of investing in money, a lot of things that they don't really teach you in school. And then you'll have a good financial head on him. But in terms of what he does in the future, that's obviously entirely up to him. And I'll sort of support him in every way I can. But I just want him to be happy, essentially.
Lloyd, I suppose I'm building upon a question I asked you in terms of what possibly the next goal setting looks like for you. How do you approach goal setting today, 20 years down the track from when you sort of first started out, for the next 20 years?
Yeah, well, Alex, I guess at the moment, I'm actually really, really comfortable and happy with where I am in life and where things are going. So looking back over the last 20 years, or even the last 10 to 15 years, it would have been sort of setting a goal and saying, this is what I want in 5 years' time. I want this much wealth. In 10 years' time, I want to retire from teaching, and these are the sort of strategies I want to use. I don't really have that. I believe going forward, a lot of my goals will revolve around my family and what I actually want for them, what I want for my son and any other kids we may have along the way. So for me, I'm actually quite happy with where I am. So it's not so much about I'm going to have, you know, X amount of dollars in the bank in 10 years' time. I'm going to have, you know, more properties. I'm going to do more investing, but I don't have a number in mind that I want to get to as such, because, you know, I'm financially comfortable at the moment, and I'm paying down debt and things at the moment. So I'm not actually looking to acquire more debt. I'll probably be paying down debt and then looking at some other strategies to invest. We've got a nice home and everything. So it's really about our family and making sure that we've got security around us for the future.
Without getting too philosophical, it's no secret by now for people who have been listening to the Positively Geared podcast that everything really comes back to your why. And, you know, from your why, you build a strategy, you go on to create wealth and to ultimately do the things that you want to do and get out of life. Because you just said something to me which really struck with me, and I love it, the fact that you said it. It's that, you know, you're quite content where you are at the moment. Over your period of building wealth through property, was a lack of content a driver behind what you did? I think, and the reason I ask is I think it's really important that, you know, people can be content with where they're at, because obviously, you know, you could go on to buy another 10 properties and or possibly accrue another $10 million in wealth, but it doesn't necessarily mean that your quality of life's going to exponentially increase, because you're in quite a good position now where you virtually can do anything you want. What are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in the past, I certainly haven't been content. You know, I lived in a one-bedroom apartment, which was way too small. And then I lived all the way out of Ingleburn and was driving 2.5 hours to get to work, and then the same distance on the way home when I used to teach at Bondi, for example. And then, you know, the next home I lived in, which was in the inner west, but it was on a really busy road, and I, you know, had this quite expensive house, but I couldn't even park out the front. You know, we had one parking spot, so I let my wife park in there, and then I'd have to park, you know, in another street, and nightmare. Wasn't content with any of that. So I very much had the driving passion to get that dream home that I wanted on the water and everything like that. I knew I had to work towards that because I didn't have the money just like that. And I was a teacher and things, so I couldn't just click my fingers and think that's what I want right now. I need to actually work towards that. And that was very much a driving force for me. These days, I am content. I've got a comfortable lifestyle. And you're probably right, Alex, that if I did have another $10 million in the bank, that's not going to necessarily change my current lifestyle, because I think we've got a great lifestyle at the moment. And sure, I'm going to keep investing and keep saving and things like that. That's all for security. And I think moving forward, I want to just keep building security for my family more than anything.
It very much underlines the importance of really having a good, a really strong why. I know it sounds a little bit corny, but I suppose that allows you to, or gives you permission to, be content throughout the journey. And it doesn't mean that you're going to get to, for people listening today that think, I'm going to be a lot happier when I have 10 more properties under my belt, because that's not going to be the case. If you're, not happy about certain aspects of your life now, there's no guarantees when you've got the 10 properties or the, the yacht or the sports car in the driveway that you're going to be, in a much better position.
Absolutely. And it is very much about your why. And you've got to remember that money, people often say, money doesn't buy happiness, or money's the root of all evil and stuff. And I don't really agree with any of that. Essentially, money itself just doesn't create happiness unless you've actually got the underlying seeds of happiness. You can have lots of money, but if you're not happy with something about yourself, for example, you want to go to the gym and get fit, then unless you go to the gym and get fit, then having more money is not going to fix your problem. So you need to be happy. For me, I take my dog for a walk or for a run most mornings, for example, because I like to get out and try to do a bit of exercise and things like that. So they're the things that, whether you got money or not, that's what makes you happy, then you should be doing.
Fills up your cup.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's really important. Having money itself isn't going to change things like that. You need to have the motivation to be able to do things in your life that creates that. And then, if you have that nice lifestyle, then that just adds to what you've created within yourself. It's also okay to get to that stage, like I have, and actually say, yes, I've achieved some good goals here, and it is time to actually sort of be happy. I don't know whether I'm not necessarily saying just be content and rest on your laurels, because I think we should always be striving for something better. You also shouldn't be in a situation where your whole life you're always thinking, I need to be doing better, and I've got this driving force to do better, but I'm never getting there. You need to have that goal, achieve that goal, and then be quite content that you've achieved your goal, whatever that goal is, so that you've got some kind of contentment there, as you're moving forward.
I wholeheartedly agree. And also making sure that your individual goals are, true to what you want to achieve, because there's no point living someone else's dream or living through dogma where you're just trying to do what is socially considered, the acceptable way to be wealthy and successful.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very important that you're living your own dreams. So, not everybody wants to live, by the beach or on the water, things like that. People might like to live in one bedroom apartment and stuff like that. So it depends what your actual dreams are and everything like that. And then you should live with those dreams and go after them. When I was teaching, I had a lot of people telling me, I'm not going to make it. It's too risky investing. I had four or five properties and people were saying, oh, don't buy any more. You go bankrupt and all sorts of things. But sometimes you just need to have that goal in place and keep working towards it and have some belief, and don't be too swayed by what others are saying or what happens at the Sunday afternoon barbecue that we often talk about. Have some belief and go after your dreams, because you can achieve them if you really go for it and you believe in yourself and you keep yourself accountable.
Lloyd, what does philanthropy look like for you over the next 5 to 10 years? Are you hoping to get more involved? I know that you've done quite a bit of stuff already. What does that look like for you? Is that something that you're probably going to be placing more importance on?
It's definitely something we'll be placing more importance on, Alex. And as I mentioned a little while ago, looking at helping in the third world countries, and that's something that we can do because we've set ourselves up both in terms of financial, but also in terms of time, in terms of the lifestyle choices and the freedom in terms of time to be able to do that, helping with maybe some education, building some properties over in Nepal and Africa, just to assist over there. In terms of what we do in Australia, definitely helping charities, donating for bushfire appeals. We've donated for flood appeals in the past and cancer council and things like that. So just growing that as well. So a lot of the funds that we receive from clients do go into that kind of stuff. So they don't all just go into to profits into the business and things like that. We do actually give them for the greater good as well. And I'm able to do that because I've actually got a positively geared property portfolio that pays a good income anyway, aside from the business. So client funds actually can assist with paying some of those other donations that we do.
It's been really refreshing today, Lloyd. In this episode, we've revisited your buying your first home. We've covered the transformation that you went through to get to that stage. And I think that should give listeners confidence that you weren't born this way. You weren't born, you didn't finish school and say, okay, great, got 20 years to, you know, build this property and this is where I want to live. And, you know, it was something that you did do over time, organically, as you mentioned. Is there any closing comments you want to give to our listeners?
Yeah, well, I think you've summed that up pretty well, Alex. But the thing is, I just want to get the message out there that if I can do it, so can you. If I can do it, so can other people. And that you're right, I wasn't born with a silver spoon or anything like that. And I started with not very much, and I was very frugal. And I just had a goal, I had a passion, and it took some time to do it. But I kept myself accountable, and I kept looking towards that long-term goal because I knew what I wanted, and I really encourage people to have a go to do that. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. And I've got that in the book just to inspire people. And even if you don't have much at the moment, even if you don't have much money in the bank, you can start to set a plan and to start to save to be able to get there.
Thanks so much for your time, Lloyd.
Cheers, Alex.